listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. It is a minute before 11 o'clock, and we're about a half hour away from Black Book Talk. Today, author Stuart K. Robinson challenges us to overcome boundaries that limit possibility in his book, It All Begins With I, The New Rules of Thinking. But first, it's Between the Covers, up next with host Jay Thiemeyer, today speaking with Portland writer Justin Hawking. Hey, thanks, KBOO listeners, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 2nd through 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. Four stages, 100 performers, including the Greg Allman Band, Galactic with Macy Gray, and Buddy Guy. There will be after-hours performances, shows on the Portland Spirit, and much more. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm/waterfrontbluesfestival2015.
This program, this KBOO program, that is, has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 42 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday through Christmas Eve. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. Also, thanks to Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
This is Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon, your progressive, volunteer-driven radio station. I'm talking with Justin Hawking, who recently won the Oregon Literary Arts Award for Creative Nonfiction for his book, The Great Floodgates of the Wonder World, a fascinating memoir, historical lesson on Moby Dick. Moby Dick plays a major role in the book, and it's a fascinating adventure, really. Welcome to KBOO, Justin.
Thanks so much, Jay. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
What exactly prompted you to do a memoir as your first real complete book in your writing career?
Sure. That's a good question. Yeah, well, it reminds me a little bit of another question that I sometimes get, which is, don't you think you're a little young to write a memoir? And I think that people sometimes confuse autobiography and memoir. You know, autobiography I see as something that Jimmy Carter would write about his entire life, you know, from birth to old age. Whereas memoir, to me, is usually about like a specific time and place and or a specific period of time. And, you know, I just think it's a genre that has taken some heat in the last 10 years. There's these instances where someone writes a memoir and then parts of it are revealed as false or fabricated. We saw that with James Frey's memoir, A Million Little Pieces. And then the whole genre gets maligned in unfortunate ways. But to me, memoir and creative nonfiction, I think it's a really elastic and dynamic form. And there's this entire movement in literature, some people talk about it as like the third genre. In literature, people in the past spoke about poetry and fiction, right? And now there's a real ascent of this dynamic genre of creative nonfiction, which includes memoir, in which people are really taking some interesting formal and emotional risks and including blending in poetry and prose and just doing all these amazing things. And it's a genre that I kind of discovered when I was in graduate school, just fell in love with. I honestly studied fiction in graduate school. That was my designated concentration that I chose when I started, but I started taking all these other classes in the essay and in memoir and creative nonfiction. And I just became really enamored with it. And I tried to write a novel after grad school, and I still do some fiction short stories, but it didn't work for me. And I think I found my voice in this genre. It is a risk in some ways to write a memoir and put yourself out there, especially this kind of book, which, you know, has some very deeply personal parts in it. It is definitely a risk, but there's quite a few other people, some of my favorite writers included, someone that I talk about a lot is Nick Flynn, who's a poet, and he published some, I think he published some books of poetry that were really well received, but it's one of his first major books that he put out, I think when he was about 40, was another, I won't say the word on air, but it's another BS Night in Suck City, which was also turned into a film with Robert De Niro and some other amazing actors. But he has since written two more memoirs. So he's a poet that writes memoirs, and he's written three memoirs. There's also Mary Carr, who's another writer I really admire, who's a poet first and foremost, but has written The Liars Club, Cherry, and most recently Lit. So, you know, you see people doing more and more of these things. Yeah.
In your own book, it's interesting to me to watch how you keep this sort of balance.
Yeah.
Like you're approaching and trying to respect the reader by delving honestly into whatever the subject is. And then you provide some humor, you provide asides that are incredible, like the visit to Julian Schnabel's house. I thought that was fantastic, which was Stanford White's house.
Yeah, the famous architect.
Right, right.
Yeah, thank you.
I am not being flattering when I say that I enjoyed it stem to stern. It was really appealing all the way through.
Thank you so much. I just so appreciate that you noticed that because, again, it's, you know, I delve into some really deeply personal material. But, and this is something I'm always trying to impress on my students too, is I tend to be attracted to writing that in which the person really kind of makes himself vulnerable on the page in some way. But there has to be some limits, and there has to be, in my opinion, I think I tried to incorporate all these different asides and different threads. And this, I took kind of a collage approach, I think, incorporating history and the history of surfing and, you know, this visual art and the visit to Julian Schnabel's house and a whole chapter about Jean-Michel Basquiat, the visual artist. And that's the thing about memoir is that I love the form, but sometimes you read it and it gets a little claustrophobic if it's just
or self-indulgent.
Yeah, if it's just me, I, and I get tired of that pronoun, those pronouns. And so I really had fun, and I hope the reader, you know, I wanted the reader to have some breathing room so that, you know, they could kind of get deeply into my own psyche, but then take a step back and learn some other things. And part of what inspired me to do that too was, I mean, I took so many cues from Moby Dick. You know, that's what inspired this book in many ways, is my love for that work. And it, aesthetically, I'm so in love with that work and just the way that it, I think, takes so many huge risks with form and structure. And it's a novel ostensibly, but it does so much else. I mean, it, right in the middle of this crazy novel, there's like an entire essay about like a taxonomy of whales. You don't see that very often in the middle of a novel, especially from the, you know, mid 1800s. And there's stagecraft and there's sea shanties. There's like one whole chapter that's just a sea shanty, like all these sailors singing a sea shanty, right? And there's all these asides, and there's a chapter called The Town Ho Story about a mutiny that takes place on the Great Lakes. And it's a really long chapter, and it's just kind of chucked in the middle of the story, and it resonates with the rest of the story, of course. But I mean, the book is crazy, right, in so many ways. And it's so multivalent and polyphonic and so many different voices. Yeah. And yet there's this central thread that at least for me really tugs me through the book. But I didn't want to just do this like ventriloquist thing where I was trying to mimic Melville, but I did try to let myself be inspired by this idea that I could do major digressions and tangents as long as I had a central thread that was kind of knitting everything together.
My favorite Melville character in Moby Dick is Pip.
Pip, yeah.
And you are talking about him in the process of talking about returning to the womb with your with the surfing and Mother Ocean, which I identify a lot with.
Yeah.
Being from Virginia Beach.
Yeah.
And, how you fell in love with surfing in Rockaway.
Yeah, in New York.
Tell me about how the surfing entered into your transformation or your resolution of the personal issue. You were dealing with relationships and some things that you describe in wonderful detail, pertinent detail.
I have to say first that I love that Pip character too. You know, he's someone that the writer David Foster Wallace has written about quite a lot. David Foster Wallace apparently wrote like 3 essays in college about Pip alone. I mean, it makes sense when you look back at it because Pip was this character in Moby Dick who was like a young deckhand, one of the lowest, kind of on the lowest rung of the hierarchy and on the ship. And he keeps jumping overboard when they go out on the whaling boats. And finally, because he gets scared, they just leave him in the ocean, in the open ocean for an extended period of time. And it kind of cracks his mind. It kind of turns him into like a holy fool. You know, that experience, that just overwhelming existential experience of being in the ocean and in this vastness kind of breaks his mind, right? And turns him into kind of a Shakespearean fool who's able to tell Ahab things that no one else will tell him, right? So I love that character too. And to get back to your main question though, you know, I grew up in Colorado and California in places with a lot of open space. And I moved to New York City when I was, I think, 28, 29, 30. I was there in my early 30s, and that city was totally overwhelming for me in a number of ways. But one of the main ways was just in terms of it's hard to find an open space there. You know, you have Central Park, you have Prospect Park. Those places are great. And I love the city in many ways, but I just had moments of like severe claustrophobia, especially riding the subway. I have a whole chapter about that.
Grand Armada.
Acute claustrophobia. And so I started spending more time at the beach. And the interesting thing about the beach in New York City is that a lot of people don't even know it's there. So many people are surprised when I tell them that I wrote this memoir that's partly about, you know, kind of surfing on the East Coast, surfing in New York City, in the environs of New York City. And in fact, you can take a subway to Rockaway Beach, and Long Island has good surfing too. Long Beach, probably actually one of the best breaks on Long Island. But it's really developed over the last, since I left New York, it's you know, more and more of kind of a known surf spot. It became kind of my escape, and it became a real solace to me, especially as I was dealing with a breakup in a romantic relationship. And more than just a breakup, it was like looking back over the entirety of my 20s, a decade of my adult life, and seeing that I kept reliving this negative,
the yo-yo.
Yeah, the love-hate relationship, the relationship where you break up and get back together with someone like 10 times. And there's like this level of codependency that is really unhealthy for both people involved. So that's what I was partly dealing with, and just kind of being overwhelmed by the city. There's a lot of good things too that were happening for me in New York. What I loved about Rockaway were just all the people that I met there, amazing people. And you know, kind of looking back at it in retrospect, I'm really grateful for the experience and to spend time in this place that I really love and to meet just such characters in the surf culture of New York City.
Describe some of them, because that was fascinating reading.
Yeah,
reading about some of the people that you got close to.
Sure, one of them would be my friend, who I use a lot of different names. So I change the names of different people. So I'll call the character that I call Sadie, who is a longtime old friend of mine. And she was I think I described her as like the Rockaway version of Gidget. She was almost every time I went to the beach to surf, she was there, especially in the summer because she's a teacher. She teaches at this amazing school called the Harbor School in New York City, and the entire curriculum there is based around the ocean. So she's not only kind of obsessive about surfing, or was at the time, she's obsessive about the ocean. And so she was always there at the beach, either surfing or taking a nap on the beach, or on the beach reading like environmental book about the ocean or about the, you know, she was really concerned about the acidification of the ocean. And she has this huge tattoo of the Virgin Mary on her back. She saw a shark one day at Rockaway Beach, which is really unusual because, I mean, you have to, if you haven't been there, imagine like one of the most urbanized beaches in the world. You can see Manhattan from certain places on the beach, the skyline, and the entire beach is lined with housing projects. You know, you see fish there, but to see a shark there was amazing. And she was so excited about it and so happy about it. And my friends and I pulled up and we were about to get in the water, and she was like, there was a shark out. You know, she was just like ecstatic about seeing a shark, and we were all a little bit nervous about it. Yeah. In the past 5 years, there's been a lot of humpback whale sightings at Rockaway Beach, which is amazing. So that the ecology there is actually getting better in some ways.
They're moving there from everywhere else.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Well, actually, yeah, maybe it's a harbinger of something else bad. But
you have a section in the book, or right following talking about Sadie, the sighting of the shark, you get on your board and you go out and it's dark.
Sure.
And could you read?
Sure, yeah, sure. And to give everyone a little context, this chapter is called As We Begin Our Final Descent into New York. And the first part starts out with me flying back from Colorado after a trip to my friend's wedding. And during that trip in Colorado, this pretty traumatic thing happened where I rented a car and pulled up to my sister's house in an urban part of Denver. And the keys got stuck in the ignition. So we're standing out, you know, around this rental car trying to get the keys out of the ignition. And these guys pulled up in an SUV and they had guns and they carjacked us. And there's actually some pretty humorous things that happen in that scene. It was like the slowest carjacking of all time, the way I describe it, and just some funny things. But I was already kind of in this precarious emotional place in my life, like dealing with this breakup and being overwhelmed by New York. And then this carjacking happens and it just really sort of like pushed me over the edge, pushed me into a bit of a spiral. So in this chapter, I've just gotten off the plane. I had looked at the waves from the airplane. When you fly into LaGuardia, you can often look down and you pass right over Rockaway Beach. And so I saw that the waves looked pretty good. So I got home from the airport, I got in my car and went surfing. So I'll start with this. And also I should say that I started doing this thing, which was really shows kind of what a precarious state I was in emotionally, which is surfing after dusk by myself into the dark. Floating out in the open ocean now, I turn over on my back to look up at the city damp in starlight, wondering where I'd end up if I just kept paddling east, if I can reach the oil tankers off in the distance, maybe hitch a ride to Asia or Alaska or Japan. Or maybe I'll drift into the Gulf Stream, let it sweep me northeast across the Atlantic to England, where I might hop another current south along Africa and around Cape Horn, then up toward the Middle East. I wonder if there are soldiers over there feeling the same longing, perhaps staring out at the oil poison gulf, wishing for the same ocean-bound deliverance, home. If I hold fast, I might make it all the way to the South Seas, now tracing Ahab's rage-filled path past the Bashi Islands and into the vast Pacific, the mother ocean that Ishmael describes as having, quote, millions of mixed shades and shadows, drowned dreams, somnambulisms, reveries, all that we call lives and souls, lie dreaming, dreaming still, tossing like slumbers in their beds, the ever-rolling waves, but made so by their restlessness.
That strikes me as sort of a fundamental dream to just, you know, just drift off and start over.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like, it's sort of what launches the entire Ishmael's entire journey in the movie Dick, right? Is he's this disgruntled New Yorker. He lives in the beginning of the book, he lives in Manhattan, and he describes how whenever he calls it like the hypos, you know, his dark moods get the better hand of him, and he he has to force himself not to step out in the streets and knock people's hats off. Right. He says, then I know it's high time for me to get to the sea, you know? So I think it is this like very archetypal longing that men and women have, especially when you're living in a big city, is to kind of this longing for escape. And that's what I was trying to tap into there. And
taking the rail under the East River, you of course allude to the Armada, the chapter on the Armada of the whales that Melville talks about.
Oh yeah,
that you're relating to, and the Brooklyn Ferry by Walt Whitman.
Walt Whitman, yeah.
Just all these. That I really liked the way you did that.
Thank you.
I mean, it was fascinating to me. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, the chapter is called the L Train, and when I first moved to New York, everyone was like, "Well, yeah, you're from Colorado. Like, it's going to be a hard transition for you." And, you know, I'd really kind of lucked out in that I had a place to stay, or, you know, in a nice apartment with some friends in Brooklyn, who were really dear old friends. And so I had a room and I had kind of everything set up in some ways. But the thing, like everyone's like, well, something's going to freak you out. And for me, it was the subway. And it wasn't like I'd never ridden the subway before. I had ridden it plenty of times as a tourist. When you actually live in New York, that's when it hit me that I'm like, I've made this decision to move to this city. And it was something about riding, you know, like you said, on this particular stretch of subway between the Bedford stop in Brooklyn underneath the East River into the East Village and Union Station, Union Square in Manhattan. There was something about a subway ride underwater that was quite long and noisy and boisterous and packed with people that just gave me acute anxiety. And this seems like one of those things that I've made up for the memoir, but I, you know, I've had this long time kind of obsession with Moby Dick, and I honestly memorized this passage from the Grand Armada chapter of Moby Dick, where he talks about in the middle of this kind of brutal whale hunt, there are all these mother whales swimming in a circle in kind of a mandala formation, and there's all these baby whales. It's just a beautiful description of this kind of maternal, universal, it's just, yeah.
Closure.
Yeah. Sort of, yeah. There's a part in Moby Dick about that. I'd memorized it, and it gave me solace and helped me kind of get over this phobia that I developed of the subway. And it's surrounded by circle upon circle of consternations and affrights. Did these inscrutable creatures at the center freely and fearlessly indulge in all peaceful concernments, yea, serenely reveled in dalliance and delight. But even so, amid the tornadoed Atlantic of my being, do I myself still forever centrally disport in mute calm? And while ponderous planets of unwaning woe revolve around me, deep down and deep inland, there I still bathe me in eternal mildness of joy. I just love that passage, you know? And I mean, it's so highfalutin, it's so classic Melville kind of vainglorious prose.
Transcendent.
Yeah.
To say the least.
Yeah. But I, you know, I had to do something to keep my mind occupied. It helped me kind of calm down. And so did reading Whitman's Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, which is about, yeah, like having that same experience above ground on, you know, on a ferry, but like having those same moments of doubt and darkness. So yeah, you know, what is literature for if not, giving us some solace, and, you know, and it's for a lot of things, but for me, that's one of them. Yeah. One of the things I love about it.
I was interested in how you got to Oregon, just to shift a bit.
Sure. You know, New York was sort of a strange little detour for me for a few years. I was originally from, like I said, Colorado and California, and I graduated from an MFA program in creative writing, and I think around 2003. And made this kind of what I look back on as kind of a crazy decision to move to New York and try to make it there for a few years as a writer. But things got pretty dark for me there, as I've described, and I was kind of struggling in my job and my career, and fairly unhappy at the job I had in the publishing industry at the time. And so for quite a few of those years that I was in the city, I was really fantasizing about heading back to the West Coast, to Portland. And I have quite a bit of family here, my stepbrother and his family, and my best two of my best friends live here in the city. To be honest, again, the whole time that I was in New York, or the last couple of years that I was there, I was applying for jobs in Portland. And we, most of us know that at that time, circa 2006, jobs were maybe a little more scarce than they were today. But I finally landed a job as the director of the Independent Publishing Resource Center. I think many people are familiar with it. It's just a wonderful resource, and something that I feel so lucky to have been a part of, and so lucky that they took a risk with me in hiring me as a relative unknown person to them, coming all the way from New York City. Once I landed the job, I decided to make the move, and it was, quite frankly, at one of the most difficult points in my life, in that I was still dealing with the after effects of the robbery. I think I honestly had a little bit of post-traumatic stress disorder. I was in a bit of an emotional spiral. And so moving across, packing up all my stuff, moving across the country was really hard, and kind of reinventing myself in a new city. But, you know, it honestly only took me a few weeks. And then I felt like I could breathe again. I just remember walking around downtown and wondering, where are all the people? You know, because it seems so relatively uncrowded here. It took me only a few weeks here to really kind of feel like I was settling in, feel like I had found the home, the creative home that I'd been looking for. And so I'm so grateful for, you know, the Independent Publishing Resource Center, and to Portland in general. Everyone here just, you know, embraced me. And again, I felt like, especially in the IPRC, found a real creative, vibrant creative community. That was the exact thing I've been really searching for. And it was the space of the IPRC and all the resources and tools are what helped me start working on this project. And I actually self-published a little bit of it first, and much later ended up getting a modest book deal. So I feel like this book would not have happened without Portland. And I think we have one of the best kind of creative scenes in the country here, and I'm really happy to be part of it.
It's very supportive.
Yeah.
Scenes. I really like IPRC. I support the work they do in the prisons.
Yeah. One of the best.
So on.
Right. Great project.
And you're now teaching over at Eastern Oregon in La Grande.
Yeah.
In a low residency program.
Yeah. So I was the director of the IPRC for almost 9 years, maybe. And yeah, I had a great run there. And one of the initiatives we started while I was there was the certificate program in creative writing and publishing. So that's a year-long program where people come and study with us. And we like to joke that it's kind of like a DIY MFA program, and very inexpensive. Relatively inexpensive compared to graduate school. I'm really fortunate in that I continue to teach in that program, even though I stepped down as a director of the organization last summer, just because I need more time to work on my own writing. And then, one of the new things I'm doing is teaching in a low residency, like you said, low residency MFA program out at Eastern Oregon University. And this is a relatively new program. And we have some really excellent instructors, local people like Carter Sickles and Lydia Yuknovich. We go out there twice a year for a couple weeks and teach these intensives. And then the rest is via correspondence online. And so I'm really enjoying that as well. And we're actually working to launch a new wilderness writing track, which will include some actual wilderness excursions. You know, there's just amazing country out there, like the Wallawa Mountains and the Blue Mountains. And if people are interested, they can go on my website, justinhawking.net, or they can do a Google search for Eastern Oregon University Low Residency Program, and also tons of information at IPRC.org about that center.
By way of conclusion, what are you working on right now?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for asking. I'm working on a couple different things. I was really fortunate to get a fellowship this year from Literary Arts, the Oregon Literary Fellowship, and also a Regional Arts and Culture Council grant to work on a couple different projects. So I'm working on a collection of short stories, which I'm having a fun time with, and I'm going to be actually going to self-publish one of the stories through the IPRC. Then I'm also working on another long-form hybrid memoir type of thing. I'm envisioning it as kind of like a big, messy, similar to this book, in that it's going to be about myself, but it's going to be about a lot of other things too. I have a friend that teaches at Fresno State University, and he calls these things like a collection of messes. and like an essay, but like a really messy essay, the messy. I like that. And this one is much more earthbound. The first book, The Great Floods, Floodgates of the Wonder World, was really about the ocean. And this book, I'm kind of going further back into my history, to my earlier days in Colorado. I grew up in a pretty small town up in the mountains where there was a lot of mining activity. It was in Glenwood Springs, and which is close to this mountain that they refer to as Burning Mountain. And there were quite a few major mining accidents in these coal mines underneath this mountain, and they sparked these fires that have been burning for decades now, like 100 years or more. And now
they have fracking to add
to
the mess.
There's a lot of fracking activity going on, so that's another line of inquiry I'm really interested in. I don't like to peg myself as a writer, but environmental concerns are really huge for me, and I think I tried to weave some of that into the memoir.
This has been Jay Thiemeyer talking with Justin Hawking, who recently got recognition for his wonderful book, The Great Floodgates of the Wonder World. He won recognition in the form of the Oregon Cultural or the Oregon Literary Arts Award for Creative Nonfiction, and we definitely are looking forward to more recognition, and we'll look for the new books.
Jay, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real honor to talk to you. I really appreciate it.
It's been wonderful. Yeah. Thank you very much.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 14th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 16th through the 19th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. Hosted by Colorado-based Yonder Mountain String Band, this year's festival includes bands such as Grinsky's Bluegrass, The Infamous String Dusters, Keller Williams' Grateful Grass, Sook Twins, and more. There will also be a late-night stage, an early-morning Cascadia stage, and daytime movies and seminars. Again, that's the 14th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 16th through the 19th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. More information about the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Mother, mother, there's too many of